From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR correspondents from around the globe. I'm Kevin Beasley. This week, limiting voter choice in Iran, air pollution in China, and joining a pilgrimage in France. The Iranian presidential election is just weeks away, but voters are facing a very narrow range of pro-regime candidates to choose from. All the high-profile or independent candidates have been eliminated by the Guardian Council, which is charged with vetting candidates for their commitment to the Islamic Revolution. And one man, a former president, no less, is among those considered unfit to run. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports from Istanbul.
The fallout from the elimination of former President Hashemi Rafsanjani began almost immediately. Calls for his reinstatement came from a number of prominent figures, including the daughter of the revered founder of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khomeini. Ali Vaez, senior Iran analyst at the International Crisis Group, says Iranians have seen important political figures barred from the ballot before, but never someone as prominent as Rafsanjani.
Eliminating a founding father of this system is quite unprecedented. Someone who has been appointed by the supreme leader himself to head the Expediency Council is now eliminated from the presidential race.
Analysts don't expect Ayatollah Ali Khamenei to reinstate Rafsanjani, who angered conservatives when he spoke positively about street demonstrations protesting the results of the 2009 presidential election. Baez says having already paid the price in public opinion for removing an obviously qualified former president from the contest, the leadership seems willing to show Iranians and the outside world its determination to control this election at any cost.
In this election, security trumps legitimacy, and the leadership wants to make sure that this is an incident-free election.
One likely cost of this heavy-handed approach is the loss of any enthusiasm among the voters for this relatively homogenous slate of regime supporters. Analyst Afshin Shahi at Exeter University in England says Khamenei's repeated calls for a large turnout may now go unheeded because the single relatively pro-reform candidate still in the race, Hassan Rouhani, is unlikely to excite the reform movement.
As you can imagine, it's going to be a very dull and boring presidential campaign. Of course, there is one so-called reformist candidate, but again, he's known for his passive personality, and he's not going to pose a major kind of threat.
In Iran, however, unexpected twists can't be ruled out, as the 2009 street protests demonstrated. Having thrown his weight behind Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's re-election bid, Khamenei found his former protege engaging in loud and public disputes with the political establishment during his second term. Now Ahmadinejad's preferred successor has also been eliminated by the Guardian Council. Shahi says there is some speculation that this gray slate of candidates is intended to make it easier for the supreme leader to reduce future political friction by abolishing the presidency altogether.
Over the last 2 years, Khamenei has flirted with the idea of getting rid of the office of the president and the presidency. And if you do look at the sort of people who have been qualified, all these eight candidates have been handpicked because of their public explicit obedience to the supreme leader.
Meanwhile, the jockeying among conservatives goes on, with some analysts seeing chief nuclear negotiator Saeed Jalili emerging as a safe and attractive compromise candidate, one who could be counted on to protect rather than reform the Islamic Republic. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Istanbul.
Air pollution in China, and joining a pilgrimage in France. When people talk about air pollution in China, they mostly talk about the problem in the capital, Beijing. But the state-run newspaper China Daily recently called most of the country's big cities barely suitable for living. More than three dozen other Chinese cities have more toxic air than the capital. Researchers say the technical solutions to China's air pollution problem are fairly straightforward. The real challenge, as NPR's Frank Langfitt reports from Shanghai, is politics and economics.
Denise Mazarol arrived in Beijing this year at a time that was both horrifying and illuminating. The capital was facing some of its worst pollution in recent memory, and Mazarol, a Princeton environmental engineering professor, was passing through on her way to a university forum on the future of cities.
What was striking was I took the fast train from Beijing to Shanghai, and looking out the window for large sections of that trip, you couldn't see more than 20 feet.
Did that surprise you?
That did surprise me, and it's really clear from that experience that this air pollution problem is on the scale of eastern China. It's definitely not just a Beijing problem. It's a national problem, and it needs a national solution.
Beijing has done a lot of work in the past to control its own air pollution.
Tong Ju is a top researcher on air pollution and teaches at both Princeton and Beijing universities. He says Beijing pushed polluting industry out of the city and replaced most coal-burning heat with natural gas.
The newest vehicle emission standard is even higher than some of European cities.
But air knows no boundaries. Neighboring Hebei province, which rings most of Beijing, has lower fuel standards. Poor and far less developed, Hebei also has emphasized the sort of dirty factories Beijing got rid of.
Hebei province very much relies on all this heavy industry to drive its own economy development. Industry that are not strictly controlled, so emissions of this industry contribute a significant amount of air pollutants in Beijing.
The Communist Party is an authoritarian regime and, in theory, should be able to fix this.
Why can't the party just make this happen? It's a one-party state.
Well, I think it's a very oversimplified term about political system in China. I think we have the impression it's the central government control everything.
But in fact, Zhu says, regional governments have a big say over how they develop their economies. Industrial provinces aren't the only vested interest standing in the way of solving China's air problem. The country's powerful state-owned oil companies have resisted pressure to produce cleaner-burning fuel for years.
Improving the fuel quality in China is very tricky politically.
Vance Wagner's a senior researcher at the International Council on Clean Transportation, an independent research organization. He says most of China still uses high-sulfur fuel, fuel that damages catalytic converters, which reduce tailpipe emissions. To cut sulfur content, oil companies must buy expensive technology, at least $800 million worth, state media says. So when the government needed advice on fuel standards, guess who it turned to?
The experts that they ask are all people from China's major state-owned oil companies, Sinopec and PetroChina. And so you can imagine that Sinopec and PetroChina have a pretty clear conflict of interest in terms of how aggressively they want to push a new stringent fuel quality standard.
This is how China's authoritarian capitalism, sometimes praised for its efficiency, can end up in political gridlock. The government, which sets fuel prices, is cautious about raising them and worries about a popular backlash. The oil companies, though highly profitable, still want to keep expenses as low as they can.
China's state-owned oil companies serve two masters. They're part of the government. They should feel a responsibility, as the entire Chinese government does, to improve people's livelihood and reduce air pollution. But they also serve the market, and these are publicly traded companies, and so their responsibility is to produce fuel at the cheapest cost possible.
January's dreadful air pollution led to a breakthrough of sorts. Sinopec chairman Fu Chengyu surprised people and took some responsibility for the problem. And Vance Wagner says the government set a dramatically lower national fuel standard that matched those in Europe.
Essentially removing all sulfur from the fuel. And it's widely regarded as the level to reduce 90% or even 99% of vehicle emissions.
The bad news? The deadline for implementing that new standard is more than 4.5 years away. And it isn't clear who'll pay for all that clean technology. In the meantime, vehicle emissions will continue to grow. This year, China's annual auto sales could, for the first time, pass the 20 million mark. Frank Langfitt, NPR News, Shanghai.
A 1,200-year-old pilgrimage route is experiencing a revival. Hundreds of thousands of modern-day pilgrims have recently followed the footsteps of their medieval forebears, trekking across France to the Spanish city of Santiago de Compostela. As NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports, what was once a strictly religious affair has now become a cultural and social phenomenon.
For centuries, pilgrims crossed France into Spain on one of four major routes, depending on whether they were coming from the north, east, or south from Italy. American writer David Downey began his recent pilgrimage, as many did in medieval times, at the Tour Saint-Jacques in downtown Paris.
This was where thousands and thousands of pilgrims would meet and start off to walk all the way down to Spain, to Santiago de Compostela. But this was like pilgrimage central in Paris.
Downey has just written a book about his three-month trek entitled Paris to the Pyrenees, A Skeptic Pilgrim Walks the Way of St. James. He says in the past, pilgrims went to Saint-Jacques de Compostelle, as it is known in French, to pray for their sins or to ask for help. The rich even hired pilgrims to carry messages for them. As we make our way across Paris along the traditional pilgrim's route on ancient Roman roads, we have to dodge a lot of traffic. But Downey assures me pilgrims of yore had it much harder.
I think it's difficult for us to imagine just how dangerous it was, how horrible. I mean, think of the footwear they had. Think of the fact that there was often nowhere to get water, clean water, or anywhere to eat. And there were brigands and murderers lurking. I mean, a lot of these people who went off on a pilgrimage had no idea whether they'd make it back.
The pilgrimage to Santiago de Compostela started in the 9th century when the martyred St. James's bones are said to have arrived in a boat to the rocky Galician coast. The pilgrimage fell out of fashion around the time of the French Revolution. It began to regain popularity in the 1960s when a French university scholar wrote about it. Over the past decades, its popularity has soared. In 1982, there were 120 pilgrims to Compostela. Last year, there were nearly 200,000 coming from all over Europe. The Burgundy town of Vézelay, whose church is said to hold Mary Magdalene's bones, is on another French pilgrimage route. Buried in the cobbled streets are brass plaques of scallops, the symbol of St. James.
Pourquoi vous faites ces pèlerinages? Vous en avez fait combien?
C'est ma quatrième année. Pourquoi? Parce que...
Parish shopkeeper Catherine Sauger wears a scallop shell on her backpack. She's doing a two-week leg of the route and will pick it back up again on her August vacation.
De découvrir des cultures, des gastronomies.
It's a wonderful way to discover the gastronomy and regions of France, she says, and walking on a pilgrimage gives you strength at every level. For many Catholics, the pilgrimage to Compostela is a profound religious experience, but many pilgrims do it for non-religious reasons, and the walk to Compostela has morphed into a social and cultural phenomenon. Pilgrims stay in special hostels, and many carry official pilgrim cards that are stamped to show their progress along the route. Leaving Vézelay, I spot a lone backpacker on a busy road.
Eh oui, hier il pleuvait.
55-year-old Pascal Bejean, a parish priest, has taken off his shoes and socks to reveal band-aids all over his feet, and he's only been walking for a day.
I've always wanted to do this pilgrimage for the adventure and spiritual growth, but whether you're religious or not, everyone is looking for simplicity and getting to know themselves and meeting others. It's just human.
Standing where the Paris Beltway now cuts through the pilgrim's route, author David Downey muses about what he took away from months of walking in the sun, rain, and snow. He didn't have a religious epiphany, he says, but it did change his way of looking at things.
And you get a really different idea of what it means to be out in the elements and distances, too. When you drive, you have no idea what distances have meant to humans for, well, since the beginning, right? In the past, most people walked everywhere, and if you wanted to cover 1,000 miles, you had to walk.
Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beasley.